It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable here on Idaho Matters. This is when we get you updated on news that made headlines around our area this last week. And today our panel includes Betsy Russell, the Boise Bureau Chief at the Idaho Press, as well as the voice of the Eye on Boise blog, Rebecca Boone, the Associated Press Supervisory Correspondent in the Boise Bureau, Audrey Dutton, Senior Investigative Reporter with the Idaho Capital Sun, and we want to welcome Kay Thornbrew with the Coeur d'Alene Press. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday to you.
Friday. Happy Friday.
So, Kay, first off, welcome to our Friday Reporter Roundtable, your first time on. So we thank you for making time for us. And, Kay, we do want to start with you because, wow, do you have quite the story about an alleged plan by the Kootenai County Republican Central Committee to infiltrate, I guess, the Kootenai County Democrats. Can you talk about this?
I'd be happy to.
Okay.
I barely know where to begin.
Oh, I know.
Right. The shortest possible version is that a local Republican by the name of John Graham came forward with a recorded phone call between him and the KCRCC youth chair Dan Bell from earlier this week, in which Dan Bell outlined a plan by the Kootenai County Republican Central Committee to essentially infiltrate and take over the Kootenai Dems by running their own candidates for precinct captain positions, then vote vote in as party chair, one of their own who has been widely criticized for his anti-Semitic writings, among other writings, mm-hmm. And from there use that position to essentially shut down the Kootenai Democratic Party and funnel donations back to the KCRCC.
Okay. So this sounds like a soap opera.
It's a lot to take in.
Because there's actually a recorded phone call, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So talk to us about that, because my understanding is this Kootenai County Republican youth chair, Dan Bell, said in this phone call, quote, long story short, we want to take over the Democrat Party.
Correct. There's a 30-minute approximately phone recording that's published at cdapress.com. He really just jumps right into it as soon as he and John Graham get on the phone. And he makes no bones about it, outlining this plan, stating that specifically it's the brainchild of KCRCC chair Brent Regan, and that this plan has Brent Regan's full approval and that certain aspects of it were his idea specifically.
So Kay, how would something like this actually work? And I don't mean to not understand this, but we're talking about, you know, party chairs, right?
Right.
So I would assume that you would have to be registered within that party and then be put up for a vote within your party. This isn't something where just the average person goes out and votes. Is that accurate?
Exactly. It's once you get into the details, it's surprisingly simple a process. Kootenai County has at this time 70 voter precincts, and each precinct has a representative, a precinct captain, a Democrat, and a Republican. And these are all elected positions. You affiliate with your party, you run in your district, and then maybe you get elected. Mm-hmm. At present, only 21 of 70 precincts have Democrat captains. The other positions are all vacant. So the idea, as Dan Bell outlined it, was to recruit local Republicans in these unoccupied districts to switch their affiliation to Democrat, to file as Democrats, and to run.
Mm.
Which, and if successful, they would certainly make up the bulk of the party at that point. Those precinct captains then in turn elect the party chair. So the idea was to, as Dan Bell put it, do, quote, a bum rush on the elections office Thursday and Friday, with today at 5 p.m. being the deadline to file, with the hope that the Kootenai County Dems wouldn't know that this was happening in advance, and forcing them to scramble in the next 2 weeks to rustle up some write-in candidates and then have to funnel all of their efforts and resources and money into promoting those write-ins.
Okay. And so, as you mentioned, this this is something that seems to be the brainchild of Brent Regan, and he is the chair of the Kootenai County Republican Party.
He is, which is kind of where it gets interesting as of today. Though he explained and mentioned multiple times in the recorded phone call that Brent Regan was totally on board with this plan and that certain elements of it are his idea. Brent Regan told me in an email yesterday that he had no knowledge of this and essentially asserted that Dan Bell was talking out of school and that any efforts that he made were not made in any official capacity with the KCRCC. So a little conflict there now.
Hmm. So what is the latest on this then? I mean, what's happening with the Democratic Party? I mean, are people stepping in to fill these chair positions or putting their name in to get voted in? I mean, what's happening?
There's been a lot of activity since this story broke early Thursday. On Wednesday night, 11 individuals had filed to run for Democrat precinct captain positions. By end of day Thursday, that number was up to 35, though it was unclear how many might be associated with the Kootenai County Republican Central Committee. The Kootenai Dems told me that they are rapidly recruiting candidates and that as of Thursday afternoon, they had just about enough to fill all of those seats. So we won't have a full headcount until after 5 p.m. today. And then, of course, there's more information to sift through. But this alleged takeover effort has really galvanized the local Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we should note, and you mentioned this at the top, is that the individual that if they can do this takeover, if they can make this happen, the Republicans want to put in place the person they want to put in place. I'm trying to find his name. David J. Riley. They would want to put him in as the Democrat Party chair. Kate, tell us a little bit about this man, because you have a pretty powerful quote in your story at CDA Press about who he is.
Right. Now, Dave Riley is a recent Pennsylvania transplant. Kind of known on a national level, and he's quickly risen to local prominence as well for his associations with the Unite the Right rally, his anti-Semitic writings. He was condemned last year amid his unsuccessful run for the post-fall school board by the nation's largest pro-Israel organization. The Daily Beast did a deep dive on him, describing him as an anti-Semitic troll. And his writings are pretty widely available and archived. And this is the individual that the KCRCC allegedly hopes to install as the chair of the Kootenai Democrats.
Right. And you have a quote saying that he's anti-Semitic, he's a Holocaust denier.
Right.
Never do now.
The specific mention from Dan Bell was, and I'll quote him directly, a guy that they call racist, anti-Semitic, Holocaust denier, that same guy would be the chair of the Kootenai Democrat Party.
And we do know that this Riley person has changed his affiliation to Democrat, correct?
He has. As of Thursday afternoon, he wrote that he had changed his affiliation, and county records show that he has filed for a Democrat precinct captain position.
Are there any potential laws being broken by doing all of this?
It's, you know, that's a good question. And at the moment, it's a bit ambiguous. There's no law against or any regulation against switching your party affiliation. Folks do it all the time for different reasons. One potential legal channel that's been speculated and explored would be Idaho's law against theft by false promise, which occurs when a person obtains the property of another by representing that he or a third person is going to engage in certain conduct without any intention of actually engaging in that conduct. This has come into play so far based on Dan Bell's comments about Dave Riley using his position as party chair to solicit donations for the Kootenai Democratic Party and then funnel those donations toward conservative causes and candidates.
Well, we appreciate your reporting on this, Kay, for bringing this to everyone's attention. It is quite the story. So thank you so much for being part of the roundtable today. We will let you go. We've been talking with Kay Thornbrew with the Coeur d'Alene Press. We'll link her story on our website, but you can also go to Coeur d'Alene Press and find it as well. Kay, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I thought there was all kinds of things going on at the State House. Holy cow. Betsy, I do actually want to turn to what's going on at the State House right now. There have been some controversial bills passed in the House of late, House Bill 666, House Bill 675. But tell us what some senators, Chuck Winder in particular, have been saying, basically calling this craziness.
Yeah, this week was the annual meeting of the legislative leadership from both parties and both houses with the Idaho Press Club for an on-the-record Q&A. And this year during that session on Wednesday, Senate President Pro Tem Chuck Winder, a Republican from Boise, had some pretty strong words for some of what the House has been up to, as did the minority leaders from both the House and the Senate. The House Speaker, Scott Behnke, was supposed to be on the call. And in fact, the call was delayed for 10 minutes waiting for him, but then he had to cancel. But what Senator Winder said was that House Bill 666, which is the bill that would criminalize librarians if a minor obtains something, checks something out from the library that's found to be explicit and harmful, was not going to get a hearing in the Senate. And was just mischief and something that didn't have to happen, and that he did not think that 675, which is the bill that makes it a felony to provide gender treatment to transgender youth in Idaho, a felony for the doctor and for the parent who allows it to happen, and even for a parent who permits a child to go out of state to get such treatment, that bill likely would not get a hearing in the Senate either. Although, as I understand it, the committee chair is still weighing that question, and that question hasn't been finalized. Senator Winder pretty much talked about his concern that we're having what he's calling a dangerous swing to the far right in our politics in Idaho. And he said, not conservatism, the far right. Senator Winder is quite conservative. He has voted for every anti-abortion bill, I think, that's ever come through this place. He is very pro-gun rights. He is the sponsor of the latest bill that has been introduced to put a one-year ban on all business and employer vaccine mandates in Idaho, except under certain narrow exemptions. But what he pretty much suggested is that some of what's been going on in the House has gone too far. Yeah. And certainly it was quite a week for the House, and there were many in the House who kind of thought that too. But I understand that the reaction in the House has been very negative, to the point that now we could see some tension between the House and Senate, as often happens late in the session, and maybe even retaliation against the Senate from House members. Really interesting politics here, just as apparently is up north.
Well, and it's interesting, Betsy, because you make such a good point about when Senator Winder says a swing to the far right, not conservatism. That's a huge statement, in particular coming from a Republican senator like Winder.
That's right. And he is a longtime senator who has been a part of Idaho politics for a very, very long time, pretty much a mainstream establishment Republican in Idaho, pro-business, but very, very conservative, very much on the conservative end of that spectrum in that party.
So, Audrey, we do know that Governor Brad Little is officially running for governor. He filed earlier today. However, talk to us about Dr. Ryan Cole. He might be running.
Yeah, so he filed paperwork that's essentially the first step toward running for office. And the deadline is today to file candidacy. But for right now, he's filed an appointment of treasurer, and he's appointed himself as treasurer. Didn't file any paperwork with for a party. He hasn't officially filed as a candidate yet, or at least when Idaho Matters started.
that might change by eight when this 3 years.
Yeah. this is both surprising and not. So Dr. Cole serves on the Central District Health Board. He has obviously become a pretty prominent person in Idaho and in the kind of COVID alternative treatments, anti-vaccine movement. And I've watched numerous presentations that he's given over the past year. And recently, during some of those presentations, his fellow presenters would, you know, introduce him or bring up the idea of him running for governor. And it's been interesting to watch that because he hasn't said, no, I'm not going to do that. So I kind of wondered, but I guess now we'll find out if he's actually going to run.
Yeah, I guess we'll just have to wait and see. Becky, we are waiting on a decision by the Idaho Supreme Court. This is in regards to a loophole in child marriage laws. This is fascinating.
Right. So we're used to hearing about child marriage in the sense of, we've heard a lot of sort of terrible instances in Idaho and because this has come up in the legislature before. But this is an aspect of child marriage that I had never even occurred to me. But apparently it's something that has happened at least three times in our state. What happens is when couples get divorced and they have children and they're fighting over custody battles, I hope rarely, it seems to be rarely, but apparently occasionally, we've had these cases in Idaho where one parent has signed off on a marriage for the minor child, allegedly as a way to end the custody battle. I interviewed a woman named Erin Carver who actually brought her case to the Idaho Supreme Court. She was embroiled in a battle with her ex-husband over whether their 16-year-old daughter would remain in Idaho or move to Florida with her father because her father had moved. And she actually got wind of what she said was a sham marriage plan as a way for her ex-husband to get her daughter to move to Florida. In other words, the daughter wanted to live in Florida. The mom wanted her to finish her high school career in Idaho because she was, you know, she's 16 years old. Mm-hmm. And she filed a emergency request with the custody judge to tell the father that he doesn't have authority to sign off on this marriage plan. Apparently that paperwork got lost somewhere on the judge's desk and the judge did not issue a ruling in time. So the father, like within a day or two, had signed off in a Canyon County courthouse on the daughter getting married to some 18-year-old kid or 18-year-old man, I suppose, from, I think, another state, from Washington State. And that effectively emancipated her. It's called self-emancipation. If a minor child gets married, they're no longer subject to custody agreements, right? So legally, that gives the child the authority to, you know, move wherever they want to move. The mom, Erin Carver, says she's brokenhearted by it. She has gone to the Supreme Court at the end of February and asked the court to sort of retroactively turn back the clock, the legal clock, and say that the father did not have the authority to sign off on this unilaterally, this marriage plan for their daughter. That ruling will likely come out any day now. Custody arguments, when they go to the Supreme Court, are dealt with on an expedited basis. So the ruling had not yet been entered as of noon on Friday when we started this, but it could come by the end of the day, or, you know, it could come, I would expect, any day now.
Mm-hmm. And I agree with you, Becky. I mean, we have heard horrific stories about child marriage. I had never heard of this being used as a loophole in custody arrangements.
Right. I actually talked to another man who was in a similar child custody battle, and his wife was moving to Spokane, and he was worried that the son, if the son moved with the mother, would also drop out. And so the ex-wife in that case actually had her 16-year-old son marry a 17-year-old girl in a Northern Idaho courtroom to end the custody agreement, according to this Boise man that I talked to. So it's happened. I was able to find at least three instances within the last few years in Idaho.
Wow.
And keep in mind, custody battles, family courts usually sealed to the public. So we don't find out about this stuff. It's not something that gets the same monitoring that criminal courts do from the press. So we really have no idea how often it occurs.
No, you're absolutely right with that. Betsy, there was a lot of talk at the beginning of this legislative session about all-day kindergarten. And look, there was bipartisan support to pass a bill, which would go into law, to allowing all-day kindergarten here in the state of Idaho. What's going on with this now? Because we haven't heard much.
Well, there still is bipartisan support for that. And it's one of those issues that has continued moving along in the legislature throughout the session, although it's had its ups and downs. And there was some drama earlier this week. The public school budget has already been set by the Joint Finance Appropriations Committee, and it includes the nearly $47 million increase in early literacy funds that Governor Brad Little recommended, which is enough to offer optional school full day kindergarten at schools all across the state, if at the option of the local school district, or the district could choose to spend that money for other early literacy efforts, whatever fits the needs in their district. There was also a bill that was proposed that came out after quite a bit of negotiation, and that was co-sponsored by the Education Committee chairman in both houses, that laid out some guidelines on how this should occur. And this week, it came up for its hearing in the Senate Education Committee. There was some controversy over whether or not it should be amended, whether the formula was the right one in it. It had some incentives for success in reading scores that some worried would penalize struggling schools. It got pulled back, but then it got approved. And then yesterday, late in the day, rather unexpectedly, the Senate suspended its rules, took up the bill, and passed it with only two no votes. So that bill is now on its way to the House. So the budget has been approved, and the bill authorizing this has passed one House and is headed to the other. It still needs to go through the House Education Committee and the full House. But right now, it looks like optional full-day kindergarten for school districts is coming in Idaho. Now, kindergarten in general remains optional in Idaho. It is not required. And there are those in the legislature who are very resistant to this idea. Not just to the idea of kindergarten, really to the idea of early education, thinking that families should control this and everything should be in the home. And we will see more of that resistance as this bill finishes its final part of moving through the process. But at this point, it looks pretty assured of happening.
Okay. Betsy, you had mentioned this when we were talking earlier in the program in regards to Senator Chuck Winder. But can you explain in more detail what this Coronavirus Pause Act is?
Yes, it appears to be the Senate's answer to legislation that the House passed earlier and sent over to the Senate, but that has not yet had a hearing, to make it a crime to even inquire about anyone's vaccine status for an employer. The Senate bill, which apparently senators, including Senator Winder, negotiated with a lot of parties, including business, some of whom are apparently supportive or not opposing it, others of whom are opposing it, would put what they're calling a one-year pause on all employer or business vaccine requirements with certain exceptions. So the exceptions would be healthcare entities that receive Medicaid or Medicare funds, because the U.S. Supreme Court has said that they can do this, federal government employers, businesses that have existing contractual arrangements that say otherwise, because the Idaho Constitution says the legislature can't interfere with contract rights, and a couple of other very narrow circumstances, specifically involving employees who are required to do foreign travel or out-of-state travel for their jobs to places where vaccines are required, or to enter specific work areas where vaccines are required. Now, this is specific only to COVID-19 vaccines. It would sunset or expire 1 year from the date that Idaho's coronavirus emergency ends, which right now the governor has announced will be April 15th. It does include criminal penalties with the $1,000 fine for businesses that violate it, And that's raised a lot of eyebrows because employment law typically doesn't have criminal penalties. It's a civil matter. Senator Winder is co-sponsoring the bill with a number of other legislators, including Representative Ben Adams from Nampa, who is a very strong supporter of limits on any kind of vaccine mandates or rules surrounding vaccines. It's also received some negative testimony in its committee hearing from Ball Ventures, which said they stood with the state in opposing the Biden administration's vaccine rules for private businesses. They don't feel any better about state rules that would impose something on private businesses as to how they manage their workforce. So the legislation is controversial, but it has aspects of it that perhaps will make it more palatable to enough to get it through the legislature.
Yeah, but with that said, Betsy, I mean, doesn't this in some ways kind of fly in the face of less government involvement? I mean, in particular, if you're trying to tell a private business that they cannot make a rule, I'm understanding that correctly, right?
It absolutely does. And that was really the big concern of the official of Ball Ventures who spoke, that Idaho is an at-will state. And Idaho has not gotten into telling employers how to regulate their workforce. And in this case, it does. And Senator Winder said, well, yes, that's what we're doing. In this case, we're doing that. Well, we're only doing it for a year. It doesn't only apply to employers. It also applies to businesses. So a business could not require that people show a vaccine card in order to buy a ticket to go into an entertainment venue or to eat at a restaurant. And in some cases, that may pose issues. For example, with touring entertainment acts who have that as a requirement of their contract, they may not be able to perform in Idaho. I think there are a lot of implications to this.
And so where is this bill right now in the State House?
The bill has come out of committee and is awaiting a vote in the full Senate. I'm sure if the Senate has yet adjourned for the weekend, but I think it likely has. And if so, it could come up early next week. Yes, the Senate has adjourned until 9:30 on Monday.
Okay, I think you're right, though, Betsy. There are big implications to this. So this is definitely something to watch.
And I would think there might even be legal implications. It might end up having some kind of court challenge. We have not seen the Attorney General's opinion on this.
Well, right, but we very well could if this goes into law, I'm sure. Becky, you've been following the story for a while now. What's happening with a bill in the State House around the secrecy of where the state of Idaho gets their drugs that they use for executions?
Well, that bill is, not to use a terrible pun, but the bill is dead. this was legislation that the Department of Correction requested. It would have barred Idaho officials from releasing where they obtained the drugs used in the lethal injections. And it would have gone so far as to even prevent them from revealing it in court, say if there was a lawsuit over a botched execution or something like that. It was a pretty expansive secrecy bill. It passed the House, but it drew heavy objection or opposition from criminal defense attorneys, even a retired federal judge, and various organizations like the ACLU. And they all argued that capital punishment requires more transparency for the public, not less. So last week, this week, I am losing track of time. It's that
we
time
all
of the
are,
session,
Beth.
Isn't it?
We all are.
The Senate Judiciary Committee actually had a tie vote on whether to advance the bill, which under legislative rules means that the legislation automatically fails. What the Department of Correction had maintained was that basically they needed this legal, codified in law guarantee of secrecy because nobody will sell them lethal execution drugs otherwise, and that it basically leaves them without an avenue for carrying out their state mandated task of putting people on death row to death when their appeals run out. The Idaho Department of Correction Director Josh Tewalt, when he spoke to the committee, he said he wasn't advocating for the death penalty. He was merely trying to have the tools in place so that he could do the job for which he has been tasked to do by the state, by the legislature. I mean, we have the death penalty in Idaho. Mm-hmm. And so he's his job is to carry it out in certain instances, and he currently cannot do that because he can't get the drugs for the apartment. But you know, Ronald Bush, who was a retired U.S. District Court judge, and he actually presided over Paul Ezra Rhodes' case. Paul Ezra Rhodes was executed in 2011, so he's intimately familiar with some of the ins and outs of these cases, right? And the legal arguments over whether lethal injection is can be carried out properly, whether it does amount to cruel and unusual punishment. You know, all of these sorts of things that come up when death penalty cases are in play. And he told the committee, like, I'm speaking as a private citizen. I am not speaking on behalf of the court. But he pointed out that, you know, when he presided over the case of Paul Ezra Rhodes, Rhodes actually asked for an injunction to stall his execution while they figured out some of these questions about whether the drugs were appropriate, whether it would amount to cruel and unusual punishment, all of these different things, whether it was going to be properly carried out. He denied that injunction and the execution went forward as planned. But then he found out years later, after a public records lawsuit against the Department of Correction actually revealed some information about the source of the drugs used in the Rhodes execution, that the very day that he had that hearing, the Idaho Department of Correction and the Department of Health and Welfare had sent a pharmacist from a state hospital in Idaho to Salt Lake City to buy the lethal execution drugs that were going to be used 8 days later using cash. So this retired judge, Ronald Bush, said, I don't know what part that would have played in my decision or if it would have played a part in my decision at all. But that's something that I really would have liked to have known, to have been able to consider. Because if I had known it, I would have looked at it carefully. And so he told the court, like, or not the court, rather, he told the committee that, you know, in at least two instances, the Idaho Department of Correction had acted surreptitiously, that was his word, surreptitiously, regarding these execution drugs. And so he had concerns about making that process even more secret, particularly in an instance where it should come before a court.
Before we take a break, Audrey, Betsy had mentioned this briefly, that the public health emergency will come to an end on April 15th. Can you talk to us a little bit about what that means?
Yeah, so we've been into the public health emergency now for, almost 2 years exactly. And having the public health emergency disaster declaration in place is how we were able to get assistance from FEMA to pay for nurses and other healthcare staff to come in during the Omicron and Delta waves. And that is a cost of many millions of dollars that Idaho will be able to get reimbursed for. And from my conversations with folks in the Office of Emergency Management, had we not had that ability to bring in, I think it was like more than 400 staff in the most recent request, we would have ended up right back in crisis standards of care, that we needed those folks to be able to relieve the pressure. But the governor, now in consultation with the agencies that he talks with, believes that by April 15th, we'll be in a position where we won't need that disaster declaration to be in place. So presumably that means that our hospitals are going to be in better shape. Remains to be seen if we will see any more surges to come. There's like a lot of disagreement about whether BA2, Omicron, the stealth subvariant, whether that'll be a threat at all. There's a lot of disagreement around that. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, that there's no other way to put it. We'll just wait and see. So Becky, can you talk to us about a bill that's been introduced to lift Idaho's hair braiding license requirement? I have to say, I had no idea we had something like this on the books.
And I didn't either. So apparently Idaho requires women who, or men, anybody who wants to be a professional hair braider. So, you know, typically textured, it's a protective style often that we see for black or textured hair, all the beautiful braids. Those professionals are required to get a cosmetology license, which is frustrating for many because cosmetology license requires some 1600 hours of training and can cost up to apparently $20,000. But those schools mainly teach things like cutting hair or hair dyeing, you know, chemical treatments for hair, things like that, which is not involved for someone who just wants to have a braiding business. So three women, all who are experienced hair braiders, they're all represented by the Institute for Justice, actually filed a lawsuit against the Idaho Barber and Cosmetology Services Licensing Board earlier this week in federal court. So Representative Colin Nash, who's a Democrat from Boise, actually told the House State Affairs Committee on Tuesday he introduced this bill that would lift that requirement for professional hair braiding services. And he said he actually thought that this requirement had been somehow dealt with last year and lifted, mm-hmm. but the lawsuit made it clear that it actually has not. So
I have an update to this story because the House this morning suspended the rules, took up that bill and passed it unanimously.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, really?
It's really something that has wide support from at least everybody on the committee when they discussed it on Thursday. So I'm not surprised it passed easily in the House. He actually had told the committee when he was talking to them that he was hoping that they could rush it through to hopefully save some taxpayers money and you know, take care of this lawsuit before it turns into an expensive, drawn out court battle. And also mainly to help these, you know, professionals, you know, get their business off the ground and up and running.
Well, and I thought there were two things that really stood out with this is I believe one of the women who filed the suit had said that she did go to cosmetology school in Idaho. She did pay all of this money so that she could be a professional hair braider. And yet she was the one asked to teach the class at cosmetology school.
Yeah. So the Idaho Statesman had a great in-depth story on the lawsuit itself and folks should check that out. And she said, I went to cosmetology school and here they are. They're asking me to teach everybody else how to braid, you know? So it seems she actually had to pay the money and spend the hours to share her skills with others rather than gaining any. And actually, I guess there's only like two tests on the written exam or two questions on the entire written exam to get your cosmetology license that involve braiding. And there's nothing in the practical exam in Idaho on it. So.
And I do believe we need to bring up what Representative Heather Scott said when this was being discussed. And I will basically paraphrase the quote, but she basically said that it's good that they're going to have this this off the books because then you can learn braiding in prison so that you can have a way to support yourself when you come out of prison. There are so many issues with that statement because it implies that that people of color are the ones in prison that they are then therefore it's an ignorant and racist comment.
It certainly raised some eyebrows there in the committee room. She did preface it by saying that they had been working in the Senate Judiciary Rules Committee, the House Judiciary Rules Committee, which she also sits on finding better training opportunities and post time employment opportunities for people in prison. So charitably, we could say maybe that's why that was on her mind. It that comment drew some backlash online right away. And it was not, I'm trying to think of the best word to describe it. I think you described it well.
I don't think there's many other ways to describe it. Betsy, can we talk about vehicle emissions testing? This is something that, I mean, if anyone has lived in the Treasure Valley knows that, you know, every couple of years you have to go get your vehicle tested. But this could possibly be ending.
Right. There is a bill that has now passed the Senate and cleared a House committee and is awaiting a final vote in the House, which if it passes, it will go to the governor's desk. And this would end all vehicle emission testing requirements in the Treasure Valley as of July 1st, 2023. However, for Ada County, it's contingent upon the state satisfying an EPA requirement in a demonstration project to show that air quality levels for the chemicals in question, the pollutants in question, have met specific targets. The state DEQ says it's anticipating that they will meet those targets. There are other pollutants now that are of greater issue. And so there was some concern about this bill, not to mention the fact that the emission testing operation, which Ada County has had since 1984, is operated by a whole lot of private businesses, and about 250 people will lose their jobs when this goes away. And so they're not happy about it either. Also, the emission testing program in Canyon County and in the CUNA area actually was added in 2009, and that was added solely by state law. So there's no contingency on that one. If this bill passes, the Canyon County and CUNA testing program will end on July 1st, 2023.
Hmm. Okay. And so where is this right now then?
It's awaiting a vote in the House. I thought it was going to come up this morning, but it did not. It may come up on Monday. I think it's pretty likely to pass. The concern is that the type of pollution that was targeted back in 1984 when Ada County was declared a non-attainment area for this type of pollution has decreased because of a change in the vehicle fleet and a change in technology and in the chain and changes in how we build roads and so forth. But there are other things that are affecting the Treasure Valley's air quality now. And certainly there's not anyone who would say that the Treasure Valley's air quality problems have all been solved. I mean, you just go up to Bogus Basin and look down and you can see the haze in the air on many days.
Right.
And so there may be other things that need to be done to address that. And there are opponents of this bill who say we shouldn't end the program. We should amend it. We should come up with a new way to come up with something. But the way the bill is written, it would allow for new regional air quality programs in the future if the legislature decides that one ought to be started. So that's the provision going forward.
All right. Good to know. Audrey, we've just about a minute and a half left, but I really want to get to this story quickly because you had a chance to sit down with some high school students recently about their reflections on the pandemic.
Yeah, this is a more like yay story than it is a sad story.
I know. Let's end with that. Yeah.
Yeah, there is some sad to it because some of these students have experienced personal loss and illness through the pandemic. But so they go to the Meridian Medical Arts Charter High School, and they started high school, and they're juniors now. And, you know, they thought they were going into an extended spring break, and turns out the next 2 years of their high school was just disrupted tremendously. And so I just wanted, they'd put together this mass giveaway event, and I wanted to see how they felt 2 years into this, having spent their high school doing this, and if they still wanted to go into healthcare. And they said they did, and they feel even more inspired to do so and to help add to healthcare staff and help care for people.
And I have to say, you should read the article. It's at the Idaho Capital Sun. It definitely is a good way to lift your spirits as we move through this time. I want to thank all of our reporters this week, Betsy Russell, the Boise Bureau Chief of the Idaho Press, and the voice of the I Am Boise blog, Rebecca Boone, the Associated Press Supervisory Correspondent at the Boise Bureau, and Audrey Dutton, Senior Investigative Reporter with the Idaho Capital Sun. And we do want to thank Kate Thornbrew with the Coeur d'Alene Press, who joined us at the very top of the program. Thanks, everybody. Have a good weekend. And I want to thank all of you as well. Our senior producer is Samantha Wright. Our executive producer is Paul Stribling and Tom Michael. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Friday. I hope you have a great weekend. We'll see you back here Monday.